This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Gubernatorial candidate Abdul El-Sayed is lashing out at questions over his ballot eligibility. A Democratic strategist thinks accusations of racism in a birther-like movement in response will hurt the candidate.
Even if he does make the ballot, which I would tend to think that he still does have a strong chance to be on the ballot, his campaign is irreparably harmed by his response.
With his history of dismissing sexual assault allegations by women prisoners, is former Governor John Engler the right person to lead Michigan State University now?
He's a strong leader. I think he's always well informed. He won't be manipulated or intimidated.
And your Cheers team prepared for Groundhog Day by mixing up a hot drink and a cold drink.
So depending on what happened this morning with that darn groundhog, then we'll know whether we need to drink another hot toddy to keep us warm for six more weeks of winter, or whether we can start looking ahead to summer.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, Michigan State University Board of Trustees appointed former Governor John Engler as interim president of the university. That's after Luana Simon resigned in the wake of the scandal over MSU sports doctor Larry Nassar sexually assaulting girls and women for decades, and no one stopped him. Bridge Magazine published an article reporting that Engler was dismissive of sexual assault claims of women in Michigan prisons when he was governor. Here to discuss some of the Michigan State University developments are our Friday political observers. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Senate. He joins us via Skype. And Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken, given these concerns, what do you think of Engler in this position now?
I think former Governor Engler is going to be tested in this position. I do think he brings a lot of skills to it. He's a strong leader. I think he's always well informed. He won't be manipulated or intimidated. I think many people don't realize that I think he is very adaptable and flexible. I would point out that Democrats controlled the Michigan House for many of the years when he was governor. But with that being said, it's an extremely volatile situation. Obviously, a lot of unrest and unhappiness, and all of his skills and many more will be tested.
Vicki, a lot of people have made the points that Ken just did, but not everybody at the school seems to have a lot of love for John Engler. What does he have to do to earn the trust of the Michigan State community?
I think it's going to be very difficult. I think he's the wrong man for this job. It's a tone-deaf response to the struggles of women on campus trying to get their stories out and have the campus administration believe them. This is the same man at a time when compassion and understanding is most needed at Michigan State University to make all students feel comfortable. I just think he doesn't have the understanding and compassion needed to pull it together. The university professors are getting ready to hold a no-confidence vote. The students are extremely upset. And when you have a situation like that, there was no open discussion or due diligence and time taken to bring in the student members, the faculty members, and the real constituents of this group to talk about who should be the interim president of the university.
Michigan House Speaker Tom Leonard called on two committees to launch investigations into how the university handled the Nassar scandal. Ken, with a review by the Attorney General's Office, an NCAA investigation, and so forth, is a legislative investigation going to help or hinder determining the cause of the failures at Michigan State?
My own opinion is the speaker was a bit premature on doing this. You know, if you look at Flint, the legislative investigation was actually pretty well thought out. It was a joint House-Senate investigation. There was buy-in from both chambers. They had the right staff to do it. You know, you've got all these other investigations going on, as you did in Flint, but I just think it was a bit premature. I think it would have been better to wait and then look at the results of these other investigations to decide whether or not some state law needs to be changed or amended.
Vicki, tell us how these legislative investigations work. I mean, will it be staff actually doing the investigating followed by a series of hearings before legislators or what?
It's probably the staffs that will do a lot of the background investigation, and then they'll hold hearings in committee. It will be divisive, and I don't think that it's the right timing to do this. It looks very much, unfortunately for Speaker Leonard, like political grandstanding because he's running for attorney general. All of these investigations are well-intentioned, and they're trying to at least look like Michigan is acting in some direction to address this horrible, terrible scandal. To come in this late and think that we're going to hold hearings and get to the bottom of it inside of a legislative chamber, I think looks more like grandstanding. And Ken's right. If you're going to do it right, you're going to have a bicameral commission and a new committee set up to do the exploratory work and the investigative work. We also have a special prosecutor that's just been assigned to the work by the Attorney General's office. So you're going to have investigation, investigation after investigation. But the real problem is, what are we going to do at Michigan State University? How are parents going to feel comfortable sending their kids to a university where the new interim president is the man responsible for not listening to over 500 female inmates during his tenure that were complaining about sexual harassment? The state paid out over $100 million to these women, all while Governor Engler was stonewalling the victims and their attorneys and the federal prosecutors. This is the situation we're in now, and it's highly unfortunate. I don't think the legislative investigations are going to add anything.
Finally, there have been calls from many for the Board of Trustees to be removed. Ken, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think the MSU Board of Trustees has done something that is actually quite remarkable. For the first time in Michigan history, I think people are going to actually pay attention to who they vote for in the November election for MSU Board because of all of this. I say that tongue in cheek when I say they've done something remarkable, because it's obviously very, very unfortunate. But I do think it's going to happen. I think in November, the November election, a lot of people who just don't pay attention to who they vote for the Board of Trustees at MSU are actually going to pay attention.
Vicki, what do you think about removing the elected Board of Trustees?
I wish they would just save us the problem of removing them and all resign. I know that that would mean that Governor Snyder would appoint all of their replacements through the end of their terms. And that's how it would work if he actually went through the removal process under the constitutional rules. I think that the Board of Trustees has been neglectful in this process, at the least.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Thanks for your insight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
The Abdul El-Sayed campaign for governor is alleging there are racist motivations behind questioning whether he is eligible for office because he lived outside the state and was registered to vote in another state. El-Sayed's followers are livid. Many of them are from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which, as you will recall, supported Bernie Sanders. They charge the leaders of the Democratic Party betrayed Sanders, and they believe the same thing is now happening to El-Sayed. Joining me to talk about that is Joe DeSano, a strategist for Democrats with DeSano Strategies. First off, for the record, are you working for any Democrats running for governor, or do you have a connection that would make you biased regarding this issue?
No work, no bias. In fact, I met out in Chicago last fall. The finance director from the El-Sayed campaign was very complimentary about some of my public comments about the campaign. So I come to this with no bias.
So how is questioning whether El-Sayed is eligible to vote, as outlined in the Bridge magazine article, a racist attack or comparable to the birther movement, which questioned whether Barack Obama was not born in the U.S.?
Well, there is no comparison. I mean, essentially, what we're talking about is a question of ballot access. Is he eligible to run? There is no element of race to this. And frankly, I believe that campaigns reveal character, and they also reveal how you deal in a crisis. And I think this response from the El-Sayed campaign that this is a conspiracy from the establishment, it's a red herring, is a failure of leadership, a failure of character. And even if he does make the ballot, which I would tend to think that he still does have a strong chance to be on the ballot, his campaign is irreparably harmed by his response, because both supporters of Whitmer, undecided voters, I just got off the phone with an attorney from Detroit who was leaning towards El-Sayed, and this person is enraged that they would call a legitimate legal issue, birtherism. Frankly, it's tactics right out of the Donald Trump playbook, and it's not going to work in a Democratic primary, and it's going to blow up in his face if he makes it.
You know, an attorney for the El Sayed campaign is Robert Leonard. He's a former chair of the Federal Elections Commission. He says, look, Abdul El Sayed was born in Michigan. He went to school in Michigan. He's always been a Michigan citizen. And then he concludes, quote, Michigan law has never held that absences from the state for school or work cause you to lose your residence. The issue is just a red herring, as you mentioned. So what are we to take from that?
Well, I think it's misinformation. Number one, although he is an expert in campaign finance law by virtue of his former position with the FEC, he is not a practicing attorney in the state of Michigan, does not understand the nuance of Michigan law. And essentially what he was trotted out to do was, in effect, a red herring. He's making a residency argument. No one is questioning El Sayed's connection to the state of Michigan. It is documented. It is true. What the question is he eligible to be on the ballot? And him voting in New York may negate the chain of 4 years that you are required to be a elector in the state of Michigan. So again, they are misinforming their supporters, pushing conspiracy theories when there is no conspiracy. It is reckless, it is irresponsible, and frankly, in my opinion, it's a disqualifier for him to be governor.
Are the Democrats in Michigan going to be further split because progressives see another leader being opposed by the middle-of-the-road and or establishment Democrats?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I'm not even necessarily sure that the establishment Democrats, using their language, are the ones behind this. I mean, this is all a matter of public record. And that's actually the part that really kind of upsets me personally, because he lied about voting in the primary in March of 2016. I mean, he wasn't even registered to vote, yet he told the story on WKR's Off the Record that he waited in line for hours and then had to turn around. And I think you have, as a leader, a responsibility to shoot your supporters straight. I think a sane response would be, okay, this is a potential issue. We feel that we're on the right side of the law legally, and we're going to keep you updated as we go along. Instead, perpetuating conspiracy theories, this is a legitimate legal point, calling people who believe that birthers in a Democratic primary is putting a political gun to your head and pulling the trigger.
Joe DeSano is with DeSano Strategies and Main Street Strategies. Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Later in the program, what parents of MSU daughters are thinking about these days. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Governor Rick Snyder is in Dundee today talking about expanding recycling in the state, which got us thinking, do you know what you can and cannot recycle in Michigan? We stopped at a bus stop in Ann Arbor and a truck stop near Chelsea to hear from some Michiganders, and here's what they had to say.
What can't you recycle? You can't recycle plastic bags.
I throw everything in and let my husband figure out the rules.
You know, toxics.
I can't recycle my banana peels or my orange peels or things like that. Anything that is food waste.
Clothing, I guess.
I'm 90% confident I know the difference. There's a few items I keep getting told, forget that this isn't recyclable.
I wouldn't say I'm very confident about it. I feel like it changes, but maybe it probably doesn't.
I think it depends on where you are, because there are certain folks that will say, we don't take certain plastic bags, and we assume that you can recycle plastic. But some places you don't, and you think, can we recycle these bottle caps or these bottles? And yes, you can, but we don't take those bottles, but we take these bottles.
I don't feel very confident in that. I have to look at the little signs, because there's the signs around here like, this is what goes in this bin and this is what goes in that bin, which can be confusing, but sometimes it's helpful because I'm like, I wouldn't know if I didn't look. So I don't have a whole lot of confidence about it on my own. Just when I'm told what bin to put it in, I'm like, gotcha.
There's a lot of confusion about what kind of stuff is recyclable and what is not. It's a serious issue. So that's why we're going to play a little game I like to call The Trash is Right. Karen O'Brien, come on down. You're our judge on The Trash is Right. Karen O'Brien is the executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. So, Karen, here are the rules. I will name an item. You will tell me whether it's recyclable or not, yes or no. If you can tell me what to do with each item, you win our grand prize. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, can you recycle paper cups?
No.
Paper plates?
No.
Plastic silverware?
No.
Individual plastic shopping bags?
Pass.
All right, plastic straws?
No.
Keurig cups?
No.
Paper towels?
No.
Canvas top tennis shoes?
Yes.
Paper napkins?
Pass.
Wrapping paper?
Yes.
Pizza boxes?
Pass.
Red Solo cups?
Yes.
Blue Solo cups?
Yes.
Okay, let's go back to the ones you passed on. You passed on individual plastic shopping bags. Why?
Well, shopping bags is really what we call plastic film in the industry. And film is really any kind of plastic that's flexible. It could be the wrapping of toilet paper rolls. It's the wrapping of paper towel rolls. It's your Ziploc bags. And if they're clean and dry, they can be recyclable, but they're generally not recyclable in your curbside bin. You have to take them back to a retail store to get those recycled.
Okay. So you also passed on paper napkins.
I passed on that because in many cases, paper products or compostable paper products can be, again, composted. If they're not highly laminated, if there's not really challenging inks and dyes in them, those can be composted in a composting facility.
You also passed on pizza boxes. What's the qualification there?
You know, pizza boxes are corrugated cardboard, and that is recyclable. It's just not got to have a lot of food debris or grease. And so if there's a little minimal amount of grease on that pizza box, it can definitely be recycled.
Pick your pizzeria carefully, then, I'd say.
That's right.
Well, congratulations, Karen O'Brien. You win our grand prize, a Michigan Radio coffee mug.
Oh, I love it. Yay, thank you.
Thanks for playing.
My question is, what happens to my commingled recyclables? And if I accidentally include things that aren't recyclable, what happens?
That's Laura Gosho. She's the most recent participant in our Am I Curious project, where you ask the questions and we do our best to find the answer. So what made you ask that question, Laura?
My mom and I were having a discussion as we were arguing over what was and wasn't recyclable in the area we were at about what happens should we include something that wasn't actually recyclable and what that looks like. Does it all go to landfill or is it something that's not that big a deal?
Let's try to find out. To learn more, let's pull in Karen O'Brien again. She's the executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. Single stream recycling, also known as commingling recycling, is when residents don't have to separate out materials. They can put all kinds of recyclables into one bin, which truck drivers then dump into one area of the truck. What happens then?
So there is a material recovery facility on the other end of that process, and that material all gets dumped on a tip floor and put on a set of conveyor belts, and it goes through a mechanical and a hand-sorting process to separate all of these materials into commodity buckets, basically, for baling and sending off to market.
Not everyone in Michigan lives in an area that uses single-stream recycling, but for people like Laura who do, what happens if she recycles something at the curb that her recycling facility doesn't accept?
A variety of things could happen. If there's really too much contamination in a load, if a community or a hauler or a material recovery facility isn't doing the job of educating people effectively, then the contamination rate is going to be quite high.
I know plants try to sort out the material they cannot recycle, but what happens when there's just too much contamination, when too many people threw in things that are not recyclable at the curb? How often does material that is recyclable end up lumped into a landfill pile too?
That's a good question. Generally speaking, the manufacturer end users of these products anticipate that there will be some contamination, so there is additional sorting by the end user. But about 10 to 14% of contamination is kind of what is expected. Everybody aims for lower than that because there's price incentive to have clean material. Manufacturers will pay more money for non-contaminated material. It's rare that a a truckload full of recyclables will get completely turned away and go to the landfill. The material recovery facility is generally incentivized to take as much of that stuff as they can, but it creates problems for them. And that stuff that's not recyclable ends up going through the system and is spit out at the other end as residual, and it costs them to send that stuff to the landfill. So, you know, it can handle some contamination. We know it's going to come, but education's got to get better so that, you know, the people who are participating can do so in a really effective way. For example, plastic bags is one of those things I think that people often have a problem with. And there are very few recycling facilities in Michigan that actually accept plastic bags at the curb, but they accept them because they have a particular mechanism or way to deal with these bags in the sorting process. So, for example, Emmett County up in Petoskey, Michigan, tells their residents to put bags in bags and then put them in the recycling cart. And those bags are plucked off of the conveyor belt and they're sent through a vacuum to a completely different part of the process before the material gets sorted later down the road. In other facilities, if those bags get through the process, they get often twisted around separating and sorting equipment, and then the whole process has to shut down, and workers have to go into those very complicated pieces of equipment to cut the plastic or the garden hoses or the film from the VCR tapes away from those equipment pieces. And it's a very dangerous, arduous work that really stops the process.
So what things should we not be putting in recycling as a general rule for all these different kinds of systems?
You know, recycling programs are really different across the state. Many programs are going above and beyond the call, and they're collecting more and different types of plastic, but it's really completely dependent on the recycling program and what markets are available to that program. So one community could collect 3 through 7 plastics, and another community can choose not to collect those at all. So it's really important to pay attention to the educational material those programs are taking out. But foam, polystyrene foam, is not good in most curbside collection. Film, any kind of plastic film, is not collected curbside for the most part. And really anything that is not on the, you know, currently accepted list of recyclables.
Let's break that down into two questions here. We've been at this for decades. Why can't we recycle everything? And why isn't there a standard recycling process across the whole state of Michigan? It seems like that would be more efficient. You'd be able to get more things to a market.
We have been at this for a very long time, and we're in the process right now in working with the state and the administration to develop funding and update, you know, Michigan's solid waste laws so that the state can provide some leadership, because recycling is really developed community by community in Michigan because communities and people want these services. And so there's really been no entity that is pulled us all together to provide that consistency so we can recycle the same thing at home, that we recycle at work, that we recycle at school. So we're really hoping that with this legislation that we have some leadership and some continuity in programming.
You're talking about Governor Snyder's recycling initiative? Is that the legislation you're talking about?
Exactly. We hope to see something that will help to really propel us forward in Michigan.
What would that do? Do you know yet?
We don't know exactly yet, but we have made a whole set of recommendations. And, you know, at the top of that is really funding for these programs. The communities that have stepped forward and are providing these services have made a priority and have used the tools available to them to fund these programs, to provide contracted services for communities that make these services more easily providable and make them a part of kind of the public service package. We hope to do more of that throughout the state in the future.
For the time being, whether I'm in a city which uses separate bins or this single stream commingled recycling, what should I be sure to do before I set my recycling at the curb?
Really, what we're trying to do is get residents to recycle more and recycle right. So there's a whole lot of stuff you can collect. And if you have, you know, a 90-gallon curbside recycling bin, it is really easy for a family of four to fill that up on a biweekly basis with just the regular recyclables that are accepted every day. The stuff that is in your bathroom, the empty shampoo bottles, the stuff that comes to your doorstep, your newspapers and your flyers and your mails, all that stuff can be recycled. recycle. So we really want everybody to pay attention to what they're throwing away and if something better can be done with that material. You know, aside from curbside recycling, there's a whole lot of stuff that can be reused or repurposed. So, for example, with plastic bags, you can take them back to the grocery store. You can actually take plastic bags and the type of film that covers paper towels or toilet paper. That stuff is recyclable. It just needs to be recycled through a different avenue to be effective and not gum up the works.
Laura, did we answer your question?
I think so. Thank you guys so much.
Did you have a follow-up?
Is there anything else besides, I guess, plastic bags that would cause a big issue or that would, you know, cause a bunch of stuff to get sent to landfill?
You know, it's important to keep your recyclables clean. Many times, if you don't think about what happens in the transportation and processing process, you know, if your metal can is not cleaned out, that metal gets melted down. But if you think about it, it gets picked up in a truck, it gets dropped on a pit tip floor, then it waits in a bunker until it's baled. All of that food and that residue can create a problem in the facilities. They can attract rodents, and it's smelly, and it's difficult to work with. So it's important to keep that stuff relatively clean, a good rinse to get the residue off. You want to keep your caps on top of your plastic bottles, your water bottles, keep the caps on them, because really small things kind of fall through the cracks. Pop bottle metal caps, you can always put those in a soup tin and pinch that soup tin close, and that just assures that all this stuff gets to the right place.
Laura Gosho had our Am I Curious question this time around. Laura, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we got our answers from Karen O'Brien. She's the executive director of Michigan Recycling Coalition. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. Usually I come here and there's one drink. This time, two drinks. This is getting better and better.
I made a Groundhog Day special for you today.
Does that mean we're going to get to drink the same drinks over and over again and never get drunk, or what?
No, we're going back to sort of the original Groundhog Day.
Not the movie, okay.
Not the movie. Although there is a drink associated with the movie, it's just a glass of sweet vermouth on the rocks with a lemon twist, which, trust me, is a delicious thing when you have a nice, fresh sweet vermouth, but maybe not what we wanted to do today. So we record these in advance, so I don't actually know which drink we should be drinking today. Because what I have done is that I have come up with two cocktails that use the same ingredients, and one is served hot and one is served cold. So depending on what happened this morning with that darn groundhog, then we'll know whether we need to drink another hot toddy to keep us warm for six more weeks of winter, or whether we can start looking ahead to summer.
Punxsutawney Phil has done a great thing for us today. What do you think we should talk about first?
Well, let's talk about the hot toddy. We just made a hot toddy a couple weeks ago because that's what I like to make in the wintertime. And at the time I said that it's a recipe that you can use anything that you have around. And this is a good example of adapting that general formula. So rather than using a traditional aged spirit like a whiskey, here I'm using gin. And it turns out the gin pairs really well with cinnamon. So instead of using honey or something like that, I've used 2 ounces of the Detroit City Distillery Railroad Gin. And then I used 1 ounce of an infused simple syrup that I made with cinnamon sticks, sugar, water, heated that up on my stove, and then just let it sit for a few hours to really infuse that cinnamon flavor. Added about 1/2 ounce, maybe 3/4 ounce of lemon juice, and then top that off with 4 ounces of hot water and a dash of Angostura bitters. Just mix that all up into a glass, and we've got a really nice seasonal hot toddy that's also a little forward-looking with the gin, which we usually think of as a warmer weather spirit.
Well, I'm going to take a taste of that before we start talking about the second drink here. Warm and cinnamon, and that really is nice with that gin. How did you discover that gin went well with cinnamon syrup?
Well, I was researching drinks for a hot toddy class that I was teaching and came across this recipe with gin and cinnamon, and I tested it. I was kind of skeptical, and then I tested it, and I was like, wow, that really works.
So what are you calling this drink?
That one's called Saw His Shadow.
Saw His Shadow. Okay, that makes sense. Now, for something completely different, because you've got a cocktail on the rocks here.
Completely different, but not completely different, because the ingredients are all the same. And if the groundhog did what we all wanted him to do this morning, then we will be drinking the Go Groundhog Go, which is those same ingredients, shaken up with ice, and then served on the rocks.
Same cocktail, one hot, one cold.
That's right. Except in this one, I added 2 ounces of club soda, bring us some bubbles, rather than the 3 ounces of hot water. And so why is that number different? It's because whenever you shake a cocktail, you're adding water.
Because of the melted ice.
Right. I always say that water in a cocktail is not just an unfortunate side effect of having to use ice to chill drinks. It's actually a really important ingredient in the cocktail. And all cocktails that are stirred or shaken with ice have usually about 20% water when they're finished. So I'm only adding 2 ounces of club soda to bring us up to that same volume of 3 ounces of water in the end.
That's the Saw His Shadow and the Go Groundhog Go. You've got a choice tonight, depending on what the groundhog did in your neighborhood. All right, I got to see how much different this is between the two drinks. You can tell they're the same, but they're completely different. This is very light, refreshing, and the other one was just warm and nice and comforting, completely different drink.
It's a really good example of how hot and cold affect the flavor of spirits. So one thing you'll notice anytime you have a hot toddy is that the flavor of the spirit comes through more, the lemon comes through more. All of those flavors really come out. Where whenever you cool something down, it kind of dulls your palate, and so you don't taste those flavors as intensely. Cheers.
Still to come, MSU's parents speak out.
Everyone was duped by this monster, you know, but it's up to Michigan State to ensure that its house is in order and its priorities are straight. And that has to start with the victims, and that didn't happen here.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, the Detroit Free Press has been publishing reports on the University of Michigan's endowment funds. Reporters Matthew Dolan and David Jesse found the university sometimes invests in funds managed by donors to Michigan. Critics say that seems like a conflict of interest. Yesterday, we talked to one of the reporters. Today, we're talking with the top public affairs spokesperson for the University of Michigan, Rick Fitzgerald. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
That first point of donors being the recipients of big investments by the university, there are lots of funds out there. Why not avoid the appearance of conflict of interest and invest somewhere else?
Well, we do in many cases. Really, what these investors that are alumni and help us are a small percentage, about 2% of the money that's invested in the endowment. So 98% of the endowment is invested with other people. We literally have hundreds of fund managers over time that handle these investments. But we're looking for the best.
The best return.
The best return, okay. And the best fund managers. And those are often University of Michigan alumni.
There's an investment advisory board. It makes recommendations to the university's longtime chief investment officer, Eric Lundberg. If you've got professionals on staff managing the nearly $11 billion endowment, why do we need an advisory board at all?
Well, these, again, are leaders in the industry, and they aren't talking about individual investments. They're talking about trends that they see and opportunities that they may see. And then the investment staff does the due diligence work that's necessary before the university would make some of those investments. So we're tapping into a resource of really some of the top people in the industry.
Do some of these guys end up seeing the university invest in funds they might manage?
A very small number of them, yes.
Donors, some who benefit from the university endowment investments, set up an endowment fund for the university's chief investment officer, Mr. Lundberg, to help offset his compensation, which the Free Press reports is around $2 million a year. What concerns are there about donors contributing to the guy who's going to make decisions where the university invests?
Yeah, it's a really important distinction in here is that Eric Lundberg, the chief investment officer, does not benefit personally from this endowment. Just like an endowed professorship or an endowed program, donors are endowing and helping the university to fund these programs. So this endowment is really a donation to the university to help offset the chief investment officer's compensation so that more of the proceeds from the investment can go to help the university in its own programs and help its students.
One of the things the reports brought up is the university lobbied the legislature to change the Freedom of Information Act so that endowment investments and returns on those investments are largely secret. Why did the university want to keep that information from the public?
You know, that's information that's proprietary, and this was some decades ago. I don't have the details on it at that time.
But it's a public university. Why wouldn't it be like any other agency of the state?
There's a vast number of information that is open to the state. The Free Press, noting this as an investigation, most of the material they used for this analysis we provided. The university does an annual investment report every year that we provided to the Free Press and is available to the public. The new investments come before the board for approval. There's some investments every month on the board agenda with a certain amount of information about where the investment, what the funds are doing.
And when you say board, you mean Board of Regents?
Board of Regents. Yeah. So and the public. So these are on the public agenda for the board meeting. So there's a tremendous amount of information provided to the public in general. And in this case, the Free Press spent hours with three of the four of the top executives of the university talking about this, and we responded to every single question they asked about it.
Now, I understand what you said, but I guess I want to get a little clearer to the point. What's the harm in opening up this information to the public?
Well, again, vast amounts of information are open to the public. We're talking about some of the specific returns.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And because we invest in private companies, and there's a great sensitivity in trying to find that balance point between what information from the university is public versus information at these private investment firms.
So are you saying that the university might not be able to invest if this was all public knowledge? Or?
That's certainly one possibility.
These endowment funds are intended to help with, among other things, financial aid for students who otherwise might not be able to afford the University of Michigan. Prior to 1995, 5.5% of the endowment went to the university's operating budget. That's been lowered twice. It's now at 4.5%. If it were at that higher level, the university could be helping more students. So why doesn't it?
More students today, fewer students tomorrow. It's a calculus of trying to find that sweet spot where the payout for the endowment is enough to provide a steady stream of revenue to the university today, but also keep the endowment growing for the future to protect future students. Important thing here to remember is during some of the worst economic times in Michigan, 2008, 2009, when many schools had very high negative rates of return, some as negative 30% on their endowment investments, and we had negative 23%, our payout to the endowment still increased. Other schools were laying off faculty, canceling construction projects, closing programs. We did none of that because of a very prudent, some might call conservative approach, but for 20 straight years, the payout from the endowment has increased steadily. This past year, $325 million, $4 billion from the endowment over the last 20 years, and a steady payout. And the university has made a judgment call that being able to plan for a steady payout from the endowment over time, every year to year, knowing that it's going to go up year to year, even because of the smoothing formula, even in bad times when we have as much as negative 23% performance in 1 year, we still grow the endowment payout.
I guess what I'm wondering is the endowment's getting a return on investment that's much higher because of the strategy you've been using. It's way above 5.5%, plus you get new donations on top of that. How would spending a little more significantly impact the future?
Well, it's really, you know, there's not a right or wrong answer here. It's really a judgment call. And the financial planners and the key folks at the university in financial planning, financial operations, the investment office have gotten together to look at where is that sweet spot, if you will, between maximizing the payout for the endowment today, but making sure that the corpus of the endowment, individual endowments, remember we're talking about more than 10,000 individual endowments for various different purposes, make sure that the corpus for each one of those is growing over time so that it can continue to give. It gives this year. So we're focusing not just on this year, but next year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. University's been here for 200 years. We have a scholarship endowment that was started in the 1800s that's still providing for students today. And it's that kind of long-term vision that's really important for the University of Michigan.
So the total of the endowments amounts to about $10.9 billion, almost $11 billion.
Correct.
It's the third largest among public universities. How much larger does it need to be?
You know, we're generous donors from the Michigan family continue to give to the university in lots of different ways. Some of the, we're in the midst of wrapping up the Victors for Michigan campaign, where we had a sub-goal of $1 billion, with a B, for student support, and we've exceeded that goal. Donors understand the need to support our students. They've been giving generously. Some of them give unrestricted dollars that can be used right away to put into scholarship funds. Some choose to give to the endowment so that their gifts can give in perpetuity. And we have to take a long-term approach for those who give for the endowment. That's we have different kinds of donors give for different ways, give for different reasons. And so that's important that we manage that appropriately in conjunction with the donors.
Rick Fitzgerald is the Assistant Vice President for Public Affairs at the University of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
In the interest of full disclosure, Michigan Radio is a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. The whole of the Michigan State University community is carefully watching what happens in the wake of the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal. That includes parents who are alums and have children who are currently attending MSU. Joining me now are Ann Gallagher, an 87 graduate and the co-president of the Calhoun County Spartans Alumni Club. Welcome.
Hi, Lester.
And Jim Kane, an 89 graduate from the Journalism School. Hi there.
Hello, Lester.
So you both have children enrolled at MSU right now, right? What kind of conversations are you having with them?
Sure. So I have one child who's a senior there now, one that graduated last year, and one that's been accepted. And, you know, for me at least, I'm not sure about Jim, but we've kind of had these discussions with our kids going back many, many years. My kids went to a Catholic school, and so because of the Catholic priest abuse scandal, you know, they go through lots of training, as do the parents and the volunteers in the schools, about, you know, really what to look for in terms of, you know, adults who are trying to prey on children. So for us, it really wasn't anything new. It was obviously very shocking, the extent to the issue, but in terms of being surprised by it, or, you know, being, you know, naive to it, I would say my kids are definitely, you know, they realize that this goes on and that, you know, adults abuse their power and their position sometimes, unfortunately. And so, you know, we've had actually some good discussions around it.
I would say, too, you know, I have a daughter who is a freshman at Michigan State, and I have a daughter who's still in high school. She's a sophomore, and she is definitely going to consider Michigan State. And my daughter's having a fabulous experience as a Spartan, with, you know, academically, with her professors and her dorm community and everything. And she has certainly been aware and been sensitized to, you know, the risks of, you know, adult predators. What's really unfortunate in this case is that you have so many examples over time where you had the Boy Scouts of America, you had the Catholic Church, you had Penn State, in these large institutions where predators were able to thrive for so long. And we've seen how this story plays out, which makes it all the more disappointing when something happened at Michigan State to see the way that the university has reacted and handled the matter.
And that's the real key issue here. What are your concerns going forward for your students and for the reputation of your school when no adults stopped this predator when they had a chance to at different times?
Well, it's not necessarily just a Michigan State issue. I mean, certainly the Meridian Township Police and the Olympic Committee and the gymnastics community, everyone was duped by this monster, you know, but it's up to Michigan State to ensure that its house is in order and its priorities are straight. And that has to start with the victims, and that didn't happen here. And you know, my hope is that Governor Engler's been, you know, taking this assignment. He has said all the right things so far, but he needs to put a team together and move quickly to fix the plumbing and wiring, to hold people accountable and do the right thing by the victims.
And what's your son say? He's not been to the school yet. He's just been accepted. What's he thinking at this point?
Yeah, so we talked about that, Lester, and, you know, he said it doesn't affect his choice. You know, when he goes to make that choice, he's still waiting to hear from a couple schools. He said that that won't play into it. His both of his older sisters, and I'll you know, reiterate what Jim said, they've had a fantastic time there. Really, there hasn't been any, you know, negatives that they've experienced in their 4 years and 3.5 years there. So, you know, he looks to that and knows that, you know, Michigan State has 50,000 students. It has, you know, I don't know how many staff and faculty and, you know, who haven't done anything wrong. They've got wonderful programs. It is a safe campus. So he looks to that and knows that this is just, you know, a very unfortunate situation. And I think what hit home a little bit to us also is my daughter, who's currently at school there, her friend growing up, and then they were freshman roommates, she was a gymnast, and she actually was seen by Nassar. Luckily, she was not one of the abuse victims, but one of her very good friends was. So, you know, for my daughters, they, you know, knew somebody that knew somebody, but they personally have felt very safe there all their years, and, you know, their friends haven't had any issues. So I think that kind of translates over to my son. He did say, you know, and he's 17 years old, so I was kind of impressed that he said this, is he said, you know, it looks like they're really trying to make some changes with the administration, and, you know, they're trying to work with people, victims, victim rights groups going forward. So he was encouraged by that.
I think you hit on something really important, Anne, which is, what is the real Michigan State? And it's exactly what you've described and the experience, you know, your kids and my daughter are having. You know, as I look forward over time, you know, the university is going to face, you know, tremendous litigation. Sponsors are at risk. Faculty confidence has been shaken, and all those things have to be resolved and resolved quickly and addressed in the right way. And that's what I'm going to be watching because, you know, I don't think, you know, my younger daughter would necessarily not pick Michigan State because of something Larry Nassar did, but she is going to have choice about which school to attend, and I'm going to be watching very closely to see how quickly the university is able to move and how quickly they're able to get back on track, because I'd feel somewhat reluctant to send my daughter to an institution that's broken.
You know, beyond this fact of Nassar abusing these young girls and women, we also have these allegations by ESPN report about, you know, athletes getting away with sexual harassment or sexual assault, not going through the process correctly. Does that shake your confidence in what's happening at your school?
You know, I watched the special. I read about it. I'm going to just kind of take a wait-and-see approach to that. You know, part of me says it sounds like all the procedures were followed. You know, the Title IX office was, you know, investigated, and various, you know, police departments or whatever investigated. I don't know all the details. But so part of me says, you know, let's take a wait-and-see attitude and kind of see what the investigator finds out that the attorney general appointed. Let's kind of take a wait and see attitude there. I don't want to jump on, you know, a bandwagon that says take Tom Izzo and Mark D'Antonio down, because I don't think that's fair or right. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot that they can't say either. So I have respect for them and their programs, you know, until I see differently. So that's kind of where I'm sitting at on that one. And a lot of alumni that I've talked to feel the same way, that, you know, you can't play this stuff out in the court of public opinion, especially when one side has probably their hands tied for legal reasons.
Well said. I that's exactly how I feel. I mean, I think ESPN was wrong to try and equate what may or may not have happened, you know, in the football program and the basketball program with something that was, you know, predatory behavior that lasted, you know, for years. They're very different, and they were handled differently, so it would appear.
In the minute or so we have left, I've got one final question for both of you. How concerned are you about MSU's reputation being damaged to the point that having a degree from MSU might taint a person's chances of getting a job?
I'm not worried about that at all. Again, faculty, staff, you know, we're a major, well-respected research university. I don't think that's going to have one issue at all. My oldest daughter has a great job with Intel Corporation out near Portland, Oregon, and a lot of her coworkers are from Penn State. It didn't hurt them one bit. So I don't think that. I think that you're jumping to big, you know, big assumptions there.
Yeah, I don't think that will happen either, and it really speaks to the you know, the quality of the faculty and the education experience you can have at Michigan State. And I think if the new administration and the changes that are made are done in the right way and done quickly, you know, we can emerge as a much stronger community and a much stronger university.
You know, what I've told people is I think, you know, if there is a silver lining in this whole thing is that, you know, Michigan State can actually emerge a stronger university and maybe even take a leadership role in sexual assault awareness. I mean, look at what the Izzone did, you know, right after this scandal broke. It didn't take them long at all to get the teal shirts, and people started talking about it. And I think that's, you know, it's that communication piece that really I think is very important. And so if anything, I'm thinking maybe MSU can take a lead role in this going forward, and that can be, you know, the silver lining if there is one.
You know what? I think that's what we all hope for.
Jim Kane is an alum of MSU. One daughter is a freshman at Michigan State right now. A younger daughter is in high school and hasn't determined yet whether she will go to MSU, but it sounds like she's leaning that way. Ann Gallagher is also an alum of MSU. She has one daughter who graduated from there, another who will soon graduate, and a son who's been accepted to Michigan State. Hey, thanks for being candid with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Thanks, Lester.
That is our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.